a lonely vegetarian sweet. You walk your feet like a maid Marian, having fun like a seminarian await. You say you're a happy Unitarian, laughing in the wind like an old Bulgarian. Hey, by the way, are you a librarian? Oh, how sweet.
Hello, and welcome to the Kiska Public Library Podcast. Today, we'll be continuing our Feast of Awesome, talking with another debutante author. This time, we're meeting Nisha Memminger, whose book Shine Coconut Moon has gotten a lot of rave reviews and is on a lot of people's to-read list. Maria and I have read it, and we thought it was really fun and thought-provoking. And I think you'll find our talk with the author, Nisha Memminger, is fun and thought-provoking too. At least we hope so. Enjoy!
Hi!
We both love your book.
Yes, it was wonderful.
Thank you.
Oh, I am Deirdre.
And I'm Maria. Deirdre.
You're Maria? Okay.
Yes. Hi.
Hi.
So before we start, we were wondering if you could just help us with some of the pronunciations.
Sure.
Is that okay?
Because I was calling her mom Sharon, for instance, and maybe that's completely wrong.
Sharon's right.
Okay. Sharon's right.
Yeah. Uh-huh. The full name would be Sharon Jeet.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
And for short, she goes by Sharon.
Mm-hmm.
That's perfect.
Okay. And would Summer be the girl or Sama?
Yeah.
No. Summer?
Summer. Uh-huh. You got it right. Yeah.
Uh-huh. Okay, good. And Molly is easy, I guess. Yeah. but her enemy friend, the girl who calls her a coconut?
Yeah. Valvier.
And the grandparents?
The grandparents. Naniji and Nanaji.
Okay, right. Yeah.
Yes. Uh-huh. So the G is what she learns to add at the end, but it's Nani and Nana, and Nani is the grandmother.
Grandmother.
And on, Nana the maternal grandmother.
Right.
And the maternal grandfather is Nana.
Now, would there be different designations for your paternal grandparents?
Yes.
That's so interesting.
Yes.
Interesting.
Your mother's brother is your mama. Your father's brother is your cha-cha. So everyone has a different name.
Wow.
So whenever you're talking to someone and you say, you know, you wouldn't say I visited my uncle. You would say I visited my mama or my cha-cha or my taya, and they would know exactly who you're talking about. There's a different name for your father's older brother as opposed to your father's younger brother.
Well, you know, that's very convenient.
It is very
convenient.
Very confusing when you're young.
That's true, too.
Got to keep everything in order.
Oh, that's great. Yeah. So, just about you, though, because I just wondered, were you actually born in this country, or are you an immigrant?
Born in India.
Wow.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I was born in Punjab.
Uh-huh.
And I lived there until I was about 5. So I was pretty young when we moved, but I still remember it.
Okay, so my first question is, how did you come up with the idea for this book?
Okay, the book actually first started out as a story of 3 generations of Indian women. And initially I started out wanting to write a story about the rifts between generations, as well as, you know, the bonds and the miscommunications and the misunderstandings that come not just between the generations, but also between cultures, and particularly when there is migration involved, when there is movement from one place to another very different place, and how that can result in so many necessary adjustments. And also the decisions that families make about whether or not to assimilate into a place that they've moved to, or whether they try to hold on to their language and customs and culture from back home, and what that adjustment is like. So that was what I really wanted to focus on.
Wow.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
I mean, that sounds like it would make an interesting novel, just like that.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people would find themselves drawn to that or understanding that a lot, I think.
Yeah, I think that it's a very universal experience.
Mm-hmm.
That regardless of whether you're a Polish immigrant or an Irish immigrant,
right.
You know, how and no matter where you move to. I think even if you move from California to New York, there's an adjustment period, you know. Each of those places has its own culture.
Yes.
And when I first moved to New York City, I could spot a West Coaster right away. And I could spot someone from the South right away because they had a slower pace, you know. There was a kind of open way of communicating that was very different from New Yorkers. And so I tended to bond very much with West Coast Southerners. And I really think that that's true no matter where that move is happening, whether it's just a move coast to coast or whether it's a move across the world. There's still that, you know, even West Coasters, do you hang on to that slow pace or do you assimilate into, you know, New York hustle and bustle? So.
But yes, to get back to the book, is it in any way autobiographical, Misha?
In the book? Sure. Yes. There's parts of it that are definitely based on experiences that I've had or experiences that my parents have had or close friends. Mm-hmm. Some of each of the characters have elements of me within them, even Mike and Molly and everyone. And so definitely, but my experience isn't closest to Sam, which is what most people think. That's not how I grew up. My mother was not cool. She wasn't a therapist. She wasn't okay with me cutting my hair. She was, you know, none of those. So in that sense, I would say maybe my experience will be closer to Sharon's, although there's a lot of big differences there as well. So, yeah, there are some similarities, absolutely.
Okay, and I personally loved the friendship between Molly and Sam, at least in the beginning, until they, like a spoiler, until they started having some trouble. Can you just speak to that friendship a little bit?
Sure. You know, it's really important for me to write strong friendships with young women, because I think that it's interesting. I just did a post for a blog that dealt with the issue of mean girls in novels. And I find that a very interesting topic because, of course, mean girls exist. And, you know, we've all been tormented at some point, or maybe we've done the tormenting. But, you know, this idea that girls aren't aggressive is a myth. It's absolutely the rivalries and the competition, and there's nasty words. And, you know, all of that does happen. So it's an interesting topic for me because it's absolutely there. But for me, what I like to focus on is the sort of strong bonds that young women can also form. And I wanted to create a friendship between Molly and Sam that did have some of those nasty moments, some of those biting words, but in the end really had this solid foundation where they really do care about one another, and that shines through, or that's what carries them through till the end.
Yeah. I feel like their relationship is very realistic, like you said. Yes. It definitely includes that biting words and that little tips that good friends, you know, always end up having.
So. And also always, particularly at that age, I think, there's always that, I'm going to go be friends with her right now, you know, and she's more popular than you, so I'm going to go and sit with her at lunch. And, you know, so there's still that. And while you're trying to find your way, there's always going to be some of that.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, that's the truth. So another character that's very fascinating, and I was really amazed to hear you say that you had some of his aspects. This Mike character. So how did you come up with him and his friends?
Well, I kind of really sympathize with Mike. I mean, you might be surprised to hear that. Only because I feel like after I wrote it, I remember getting several emails from young women who said, "Oh my God, I know Mike, you know, Mike walks through my halls at school."
And I think he does.
also with him, it was important for me to make sure that he was layered with complexity as well. You know, he's this young man who's trying to find his way in the world without a father figure. Mm-hmm. And with a mom who's trying to, like Sam's mom, which is basically how they connect, who's trying to be a single mother. Mm-hmm. And so he's kind of forced into this situation where he's got to drop out of school and help his mom out with bills. And so what does that do to a young man? You know, what kind of responsibility does this end up laying on his shoulders? And how does he deal with it? How does he cope with it? And how does that affect his intimate relationships?
Right.
And so those are some of the things I wanted to look at, you know.
Yeah, Nisha, I did feel sorry for him because I felt as if, in a way, it's a cop-out, but he's not just deferring his dreams. He's saying they're not going to happen anymore.
Yeah.
And it's very sad.
It really is. And sadly, it happens all the time.
Yeah.
You know, it really does. And I think that that's part of it. He, in some ways, does give up. And Sam's desperately trying to hold on. And that's part of where their impasse comes in the relationship, you know.
Right.
So she's trying to create new dreams or exploring some growth avenues. And he's felt like that's it for him. You know, and in that respect, I could certainly identify with him. I mean, not that I've given up on anything, but I've known people who have. And I understand that tendency. I mean, we've all wanted to give up at some point, you know, where the odds just seemed tremendous.
Right, I know. It's so sad, though, to give up when you're 17 or...
Yes, you know. Yes. But then you look back and, you know, now with Facebook, you can see where people are at if they're alive.
Right. That's true.
You know, people you knew in high school. And you're like, oh, there's Mike, you know.
Yeah.
Well, I was going to actually ask about Uncle Sandeep, because I love that relationship as it develops between Sam and her uncle, and how she's, you know, she kind of gets another view into her mom and her life as she sees them interacting with each other.
Yeah.
And I don't know, I feel like I instantly liked him. Kind of like Molly, when she was just calling him Uncle Sandeep from the beginning. I kind of felt like that, like he was uncle.
He's very warm and personable.
He's kind of like the communal uncle. Well, he was sort of a composite of characters. When I was writing Uncle Sandeep, I was thinking about my brothers. Mm-hmm. I was thinking about some of my uncles. I drew upon mainly the personalities of my brothers. And yes, of some of my uncles and some of my cousins who are uncles. The ones particularly who don't have children of their own and feel no need to not tell their moms and, you know, or their sisters' entire secrets to the kids. You know, no self-censorship whatsoever. Yeah. And so my own girls have these great relationships with my brothers that I'm not allowed to take part in, really, you know, because they'll go away and, like, shut the doors and then grill my brothers about my past.
You know, that's
and
so funny.
Yeah, when I'm carefully watching what I say around them and parts of myself that I'm really, really careful to portray a certain way, all gets blown out of the water when my brothers visit. And so I think that's a really fun connection for them, though, you know, and I'm really glad that they have it and they get to see their moms, you know, I'm talking about also my nieces and nephews. So, you know, when I go to my brother's house, trust me, I do the same for him. His kids get all kinds of versions of when we were growing up also. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's a fun connection for kids. It's an insight into their parents' lives that they wouldn't otherwise get, and things that their parents wouldn't necessarily share with them, another adult can. It doesn't always have to be an uncle. But I definitely wanted that because the mom in this particular story is so mysterious for Sammy, and her background is shrouded in secrets and things that Sammy doesn't know, even about her own father. So I really wanted some way for her to be able to go after that information herself.
Yeah, yeah. And in some ways, it makes Sharon seem a little bit young at the end when you realize, oh, she was like this young girl and her parents were right. Yeah. And she was wrong and this happens. And
yeah.
And she never wanted to admit that to her daughter.
Yeah.
Yeah. But one thing I loved about the ending is that nobody's perfect, you know, because the grandparents also have their issues.
Right. Yeah. You know, I think it's always a two-way street,
yes.
You know? Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, there was things on both ends. And I think I work really hard in all of my writing to not sort of paint any characters all bad or all good, because I really don't believe that's how it is in mm-hmm. life either. But I'm a strong believer also in taking responsibility and accountability. So there is that. And I definitely wanted, in this story, both Sharon and her parents have trouble taking responsibility, you know, mm-hmm. and owning up to what their parts were. So while I wanted to see some movement there,
right.
the reality is that it's very hard. You know, these kinds of connections are very hard. Uh-huh. Particularly family. Family is just such a mess.
Well, large, so, complicated families. Yes. Yeah.
Very complicated, yes. Uh-huh. And as much as you love people in your family, there's still always these complex layers that we're looking at. So.
Yeah.
It's very true.
Mm-hmm. Which brings me to Belvoir.
Yes.
Because I thought it was so interesting that this girl is the one who flings that insult at our heroine here.
Yeah.
Calling her a coconut. But yet she transforms herself into something entirely antithetical to the culture every day.
Yes, isn't that ironic?
Wait a minute, who are you? So are you ever going to do a book about Belvoir?
That's an interesting question, you know? Definitely, Belvoir is a very interesting character.
Uh-huh.
And when I was growing up, I was surrounded by Belvoirs. And Belvoirs exist en masse in various parts of the world, particularly places like the UK and Canada, where South Asians have immigrated and been able to maintain a lot of the cultural traditions and customs.
Right.
So there are areas in Canada and also on the West Coast, California. I'm thinking particularly of a couple of cities in Southern California
mm-hmm.
where traditions are strong still.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so young women are still expected to adhere to these traditions and customs from back home, and yet they're living in this world now where they have to survive among their peers.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of that. You know, there's a lot of, you leave home, the good Indian girl, and you get to school, and all of a sudden you're this wild, you know, tight skirt wearing, smoking girl. And so I really had fun writing Belvoir because I thought, oh, good, here's where I can really let loose and write about this girl who's busting out, you know,
mm-hmm.
or really wants to bust out. And I contrasted her school self with the girl that we see in the mall. And I really wanted to show the two different aspects of, you know, this life that she's living.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks for pointing out that irony there where she says sort of offhandedly, oh, so you're a coconut. You don't really know who you are.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I thought
the voice of wisdom. Yeah.
I know. And I look at that conversation as sort of like a small turning point for Sammy, or I'm not sure if it's a small one or a large one, but that kind of, you know, puts her on her way into examining more of her heritage and learning more about Sikh culture. And, so I feel like without Belvoir there, that wouldn't have happened. So she's really important to the story.
Yes. Yes. Absolutely. And Belvoir is kind of something for Sam to measure her Indianness against.
Mm-hmm,
you know,
right.
Here's this girl who's living this life where she's absolutely steeped in Indian culture and tradition, and Sammy is not. she never has been.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is all she has now to measure her Indianness against. And that's when she discovers that without realizing it, she had been living this life where she was surrounded by people who were not Indian, very Americanized, very much assimilated into American society and culture and values. So that was her first understanding, or her first clash with her own self and her own identity. Mm-hmm. It was a catalyst for a lot of her own self-discovery.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's very true. Very true. And I have to tell you, I loved the description of the temple and all of the developments that happened there. And I did check out the websites also, but I couldn't find Seek Out, but the others were really interesting.
Yeah, you, know, you won't find Seek Out. That, I made that up.
Uh-huh. Okay. Yeah.
But the
I
other
love
one.
The name. Yeah. There yeah. should be one.
Yes. Yeah, the other ones were based on actual sites.
Yes, yeah, which I did examine and found some very interesting things. So
yeah,
and I love that, where a book can take you further into finding things out about the world. So.
Oh, yeah. And the temple scene, I went back to my days, my childhood, when we would go to temples. And that temple was also a composite of many of the different temples we'd visited. And I really wanted to get that sense also of the culture clash there. You know, here you are walking into this Sikh temple, and it's decorated with Christmas lights.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah.
And there it's like, wait a minute. Okay, Christmas equals Christ equals Christianity. Mm-hmm. And here you are in this Sikh temple. And that sort of juxtaposition between the Punjabi words and the English words and all of this going on, where... For me, I really wanted to get across that culture is never this clear-cut, defined thing.
Uh-huh.
And it's always fluid and in flux, and people bring their own interpretations to it.
Mm-hmm.
Like you said about Balvir. For her, it's like, well, I know who I am, but who are you? And yet, really, does she know who she is, you know? And with movement and migration, all of those definitions get reshaped. For example, when you think about the term Asian, in Britain, Asian means South Asian, people who are of Indian, Pakistani, Sri Lankan background. Whereas in the U.S., Asian means something very different. It means East Asian.
Uh-huh.
And so, you know, all of these definitions don't mean the same thing.
Right.
So it's very fluid, and it depends on where you live. It depends on geography. It depends on history. And so, you know, the whole idea of culture and identity is constructed based on who, the person who's defining it. So I wanted to get that across as well with the temple and the Christmas lights and even the cutting the hair and the parents saying it's okay for men to cut their hair because they have to work and it's not okay for women to cut their hair, you know, all of that. So the interpretations of culture.
Yeah, interesting.
It's very interesting. And I just feel like with the temple, I like how Sam sort of almost had that instant connection. Like, she felt that calm when she was there the first time, if I'm not mistaken. So
right.
Then what happens closer to the end of the novel, it sort of really hits her hard. I feel like that was good. You know, I don't want to give away too much to our listeners.
Yes, right, yeah. It's a big scene, yeah.
Yeah, it really resonates with her, like the impact of that. And I liked how that happened with her.
Yeah. I think, you know, there's been some talk on the internet in recent weeks about addressing the topic of faith in novels, particularly YA novels. And I think for me, spirituality is something that will always be threaded throughout my work, because I think that whatever it is, whether it's an organized religion, whether it's just a belief that there's a higher force, or even a belief that there is no force, there's some sort of belief. And so, you know, and I think that there are young people asking these questions and wanting and doing that exploration. So in my work, there's always some of that exploration. And for Sam, you know, her mother is an atheist.
Uh-huh.
she doesn't believe, and she raised her daughter that way. And this is Sam's introduction into some of those issues and questions.
Yeah, I did really enjoy that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Thought it was quite beautiful, that scene.
Oh, I'm glad. Yeah.
So, I just always ask the same thing to authors, that I love that these books are flying off the shelves and kids are reading them, but I'm seeing a lot of kids with their own ideas for how to be creative and so on. And what would you have to advise a young person who might want to emulate you as an artist or a writer?
See, if a young person was trying to write...
Trying to be creative. Or
creatively, yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, my primary biggest recommendation would be to write.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to get a big blank book and fill it.
Mm-hmm.
There are books like The Artist's Way by, I think it's Juliet Cameron, that are really, really great to read if they're interested.
Mm-hmm.
And they also have exercises in them. I don't know if you've heard of this book, but she has exercises in nurturing your creativity.
Mm-hmm.
And I think at that age, as particularly when you're young and you're just starting out, or if you've done it for a few years, the most important thing is to be creative and to allow your creativity free rein.
Uh-huh.
And not to have the pressure of trying to create something or some kind of a product, but just to write. And to write in all different forms, all different genres. Mm-hmm. Write in genres you're uncomfortable writing in and explore. Write sci-fi, write fantasy, write romance, mystery, write high literature, whatever you think that might be. Write like Shakespeare, and try all of those different things and see what fits best and which type of writings there are that you start writing and just don't want to stop, you know, where hours go by, you don't even realize, and you don't think about eating, you don't think about using the bathroom, you don't, you know, this is where you're just immersed in it. And I think that that's what we want to get to. And it's creative expression, so we don't want to censor it. We want to start learning to get rid of that inner censor that we all have, you know.
Uh-huh.
And that inner censor takes so many different forms. It can be, oh, you'll never be a writer, or, oh, this is no good, or, you know, it can be any of those things. And we're trying to blast through that.
Mm-hmm.
So that really all you're doing is writing, and you want to let that creativity just flow unobstructed. And that's the goal at this point, I think, to just really allow your creativity to flow without any kind of obstacles. And so my biggest suggestion would be to get tons of books and fill them. At this point, the goal is not quality, it's quantity. Really, every day. You know, keep a journal. Try different prompts. If you want to write creatively, try poetry, try short stories, journalism, all of those different types of writing.
Mm-hmm.
And once you start filling books in that vast amount of writing that you have, you'll find kernels in there that are just golden nuggets that you can at some later point expand on and turn into a story or turn into a poem.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's where the magic is.
And I have one final question that maybe will reveal a little of my prejudices. I just think that your writing is very masterful, very beautifully done, without awkwardnesses of any type. And I've noticed that seems to be a common thing with Indian writers. I mean, there's some wonderful, wonderful prose coming out of India. And I wonder why that is. Is it because English is a second language, as they say with Joseph Conrad, because he learned English? It was so beautifully done.
I'm sure that might have something to do with it as well. First of all, thank you for the compliment.
Oh,
that's
you're
so
welcome.
Sweet of you. And I do think that there's a noticeable rhythm to writings. It's what I call an aesthetic. And I think there's an aesthetic that comes with every tradition.
Mm-hmm.
So there's Irish writing, there's Indian writing, there's Native American writing, you know, of which Sherman Alexie is part
of
a tradition of that.
Wonderful.
Yes, yes,
love
I love his stuff. And so, but, you know, when I read Native American authors, I definitely see a tradition of writing. And I immediately, within the first few pages, fall into that rhythm with the author. And I think that might be what you're referring to. It might be that there's this tradition of writing that I'm a part of. And I think part of what makes that tradition is the language. I've often said that sometimes, particularly when I'm writing description, I think in Punjabi. And so I have to do that work of thinking in Punjabi and then translating it. And so then my translations come from a Punjabi aesthetic, which I think is identifiable to those who are reading it, whether they know it or not. There is this recognition that, oh, okay, here's this description that's not like anything I'm used to seeing, and it's a new way of seeing the world. Okay, and for me, it's my way of seeing it, based on, you know, the cultures and traditions and the language and the rhythms that I've grown up with.
Right, and I remember this because I guess we both speak different languages too, but I studied German language in college and went to Germany and studied there, and I was really struck by the differences in colors, because know, in the Irish language there are many different words for green, many more than in English, and Germany, I was really struck that certain shades that we would call purple, they call blue. And what we call fuchsia pink, they call red.
And
I was amazed. It's like they see the colors, but the names are so different. And and always there's a difference then in the description.
Absolutely. It's a different way of seeing. My mother also, every time she saw orange, she would say, oh, go get the yellow one. And I would look around for something that was yellow and not find anything and say, what are you talking about? That one, the yellow one right there. And it was orange. And so the same kind of thing, you know, where there's, it's just a completely different way of seeing. And I had to learn that. It was like learning a language, even though I knew what she was saying. It was a different way of seeing things.
Right.
So
absolutely. And I guess that this kind of thing was interesting to me ever since high school, because we took an American Indian class that was marvelous, and we learned some Lakota. And one thing I learned that fascinated me was that they have the same word for blue and gray. And when I thought about it, I was like, oh yeah, it's the sky. It's all the colors of the sky. And
that's so cool. Wow. And it's that reference point, right?
Exactly. It's the reference point.
That's incredible.
That's very interesting.
So
all these things we're learning.
It's just, I love when books open stuff up to me and bring memories to me, too, that I otherwise might not.
And when you sort of learn something about yourself that you didn't even realize was there to learn.
Which your book definitely does.
Thank you.
Yeah, I think so. I think for me as well, I kind of recognize a little bit of Sammy and myself just dealing with the different generations of people in her family and dealing with finding out about yourself. I think I was always immersed in Italian culture growing up, but then I reached a point maybe in college where I realized I was maybe too American in my parents' eyes, you know, so I kind of had to go back and learn some of that again. So I, you know, I was glad. I kind of felt like I recognized that in Sammy, and that made me like the book even more, because there was that commonality there.
And I think there will be a commonality even for kids who are American. Why do I say even? Maybe especially.
I think so too. I think also it's like what we were talking, I mean, as you're talking about your Italian heritage, Maria, I'm thinking it wasn't too long ago that arranged marriage was very common among Italians also. And dowries and all of those things were very much a part of Italian culture. And recently, this is a secret, so don't tell anybody, but one of my guilty pleasures.
You need to edit this out?
Yeah. No. Okay. One of my guilty pleasures is The Tudors. Which is the HBO series.
Yes, I've seen it.
I know. I watch it when nobody's home, and I watch it, like, back to back. But what's really interesting to me about that also is that in those times, in King Henry's times, but also in Elizabethan times, arranged marriage was prevalent, as were dowries, as were, you know, so...
Yes,
this is part of even English history and European history, and so there's not that much of a difference. But that's what we're talking about. We're talking about an evolution of culture and tradition and new generations and how new generations respond to old traditions and customs and so on.
Yes, very true.
There are people coming in.
Now, because all of my little children are here. But
yay!
This was so delightful.
It was so wonderful.
Oh, thank you so much. So I had such a blast. It was wonderful meeting you both.
Yes.
Thank you.
So, yes, we'd like to say thank you very much for speaking with us.
Oh, the pleasure. Thank you so much, both of you.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank
have
you.
Have a wonderful day.
You too.
Okay, bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to our podcast. We hope you enjoyed our lovely conversation with Nisha Meminger.
Stay tuned for future episodes featuring more of your favorite authors,
such as Pam Beshores, Sarah Reese Brennan, and Aaron Dion.
Yes, and remember, any of their books, or if you have any other information needs, is one place you can go and you can get anything for free. That's right, your library.
Watching TV.
You're there.
The section's about almost everything. You'll always find something you're interested in. Place tectonics or embroidery. Michael Portillo or the banyan tree. The library, the library.